Hello and welcome to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the unceded homelands of the Mohican people who are known today as the Stockbridge-Munsee community. I'm Sina Bazila Hickey.
And I'm Kathy Silber. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we start off with the latest on the union drive at Joseph's House from night shift staffer and organizing committee member Jay Conlin. And then Mark Dunley talks with Melanie Trimble of the Capital District Chapter of the New York Civil Liberties Union about the Supreme Court's decision to overturn a longstanding New York gun law. Later on, Penny Holmes, director of the ARC in Troy, joins us to talk about trauma-informed services in the Capital District. And after that, producer Elizabeth Press and Max Burke bring us the word about Reclaim Pride in the Capital District and the Albany festivities coming up on Saturday. And finally, Shauna Davis of the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists joins our weekly check-in with a community group to tell us what's what. And tonight, before we jump to the headlines, I just want to give a shout out to my co-host, H. Bosch Jr., whose expertise in overcoming adversity has been sorely challenged these many weeks. Bosch, I miss you. All your listeners out there in radio land miss you. Be well. Come back soon. And now for the headlines.
Well, we start with a pretty big headline, and in a 6-3 split decision, the conservatives of the United States Supreme Court, led by Clarence Thomas, struck down a centuries-old New York gun control law, holding that Americans have a right to carry a handgun outside the home for self-defense, that the New York law requiring a show of special needs for such a permit was too restrictive. The dissenters noted that, quote, many states have tried to address some of the dangers of gun violence by passing laws that limit, in various ways, who may purchase, carry, and use firearms of different kinds. The court today severely burdens states' efforts to do so, end quote. It was not until 2008 that Supreme Court ruled for the first time that the Second Amendment bestowed an individual's right to keep a gun in the home for personal defense rather than related to military use. Our second story today is NYCLU's reaction to this decision.
The Times Union reports that a number of extreme risk protection orders being filed by the state police has surged in the wake of an executive order issued by Governor Kathy Hochul last month that mandated troopers pursue the court applications whenever they encounter a person who is, quote, likely, end quote, to be at risk of harm to themselves or to others. But cases are often dismissed due to lack of resources, especially attorneys, to follow through, even though almost all cases involve guns.
The Troy Savings Bank Music Hall has announced the return of the Barker Park Kids Concert Series. The free outdoor series takes place every Thursday at 11 a.m. from July 7th to August 25th at the corner of 3rd Street and State Street in Troy.
The Times Union reports that a Juneteenth celebration on Central Avenue briefly turned into a shoving match after a confrontation between police and organizers Sunday afternoon, resulting in a 12-year-old boy being thrown to the ground by a city police officer. The police were responding to complaints from City Councilmember Joyce Love and others about noise and double-parked cars, and contended that the group was not allowed to serve free food outside their businesses. The city had denied them a permit to close down the street, saying the event was too small.
The Little Critters Water Park at the Veterans Memorial Swimming Pool in Watervliet will be opening starting Monday after several years of effort by the city to raise the funds. A local business person donated $500,000 for the splash pad.
The U.S. Department of Education has agreed to cancel $6 billion in student loans of 200,000 people who brought a class action lawsuit against the government claiming they were stuck with federal debts from dozens of schools that were found to have misled them. The White House is also reportedly considering a far more widespread cancellation of up to $10,000 in debt per student with a price tag of several hundred billion dollars.
And our last headline comes from Public News Service.
Older people in New York are dying from drug overdose or suicide at much higher rates now compared with a decade ago, according to the latest America's Health Rankings senior report from United Healthcare. The report found in New York, suicides have increased nearly 10%, frequent mental distress is up about 9%, and drug deaths among people 65 and older have doubled in the last 10 to 12 years. Dr. Rhonda Randall with United Healthcare said the social distancing required during COVID has taken a particularly heavy toll on older people.
The risk of social isolation is measuring a lack of meaningful social connectedness among seniors, and so things that put you at risk are being never married, widowed, divorced, not separated, living alone, living in poverty.
New York ranked 32nd overall in the report. There is some good news. Between 2011 and 2020, the number of adults reporting high health status went up 30% in the state. And since 2016, there are nearly 30% more home health aides able to provide care to older New Yorkers. Alex Malaise is with the group Save the Michaels of the World in Buffalo, a peer support organization for folks struggling with addiction. She points to fentanyl as a major cause of the uptick in drug-related deaths because it's 50 to 100 times more potent than morphine, and it's showing up in heroin, cocaine, OxyContin, and other drugs with more and more frequency.
People aren't necessarily overdosing or dying because they've done too much of something. It's happening on accident, which is terrifying. So somebody who might be experimenting with their first line of cocaine might have a terrible reaction, which could lead to death.
Malaise notes more than 8,000 people have called for help this year alone. She says it can mean a lot to people to talk to someone who's gone through what they're going through. She says sharing that she has 10 years of continuous sobriety can help people realize they have that power too.
There's so much stigma and shame around it that people don't want to talk about it. There is a lot of different avenues for recovery. So it's not just NA anymore or AA anymore. There's so many different ways that people could get well.
I'm Lee Bolke reporting. Find our 8 trust indicators for transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
And that's it for the headlines.
For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. Do you like what you hear? You can find all these stories and more at mediasanctuary.org/stories. To learn how you can contribute, go to mediasanctuary.org, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org, or call 518-272-2390. For tonight's labor segment, we're pleased to welcome to the show Jay Conlin, who works the night shift at Joseph's House and is a member of the organizing committee that just went public with their union drive. Welcome, Jay.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tell us what we need to know. What's going on over there at Joseph's House?
Sure. We are unionizing, and this has been in the works for a few months. It started as a conversation between like two individuals, which kind of turned into a small group of people. And that kind of turned into like talking to SEIU, Service Employees International Union, about what does that look like? How does that come into fruition? Which these conversations keep happening. We're like figuring out how to do this. And like in about like 2 to 3 months, we're looking at like 60% of our staff are on board with unionizing, are on board with working together to ensure better conditions. There you go. Thank you. Yeah, working conditions. And actually, we've just filed Wednesday that just passed, this 22nd of June, with the National Labor Relations Board, and we're ready to go take it to a vote because we went public, I believe, 3 weeks ago, and maybe a month, but shortly after the board of directors passed a resolution, I think it was 12-2, that they will not voluntarily recognize our union, but then released a statement shortly after saying they will be impartial to the vote, and it's up to their employees, us, to decide if we would like to unionize or not. So we're looking for the vote. And we're looking forward to the vote. We're looking forward to succeeding in winning the vote and becoming a union to better collaborate on building these conditions that can protect us as the staff and better protect the homeless populations that we are also serving as well.
Take a little breath. You look a little exhausted. Yeah. We're on a Zoom call here. I just want to jump in and say 2 to 3 months to get to 60% in my book is really fast. 12 to two, ouch. Has the NLRB set your election date yet?
No, we are on the docket. We found ourselves on the docket, but we do not. I personally don't know as the date as of yet. But I mean, I'm in constant communication with the team. So our union rep, Sean, he will definitely keep us updated as to what's going on with the SEIU, the National Labor Relations Board, and when the election date will be. We're all really excited. I personally believe it's like a drive that's going to come to fruition. We're going to succeed. Everyone's behind us. Like we said, it was so fast how we got there because we are already such like a great team that collaborates really well as the workers at this this base level. We know how to do this work, and that kind of communication that we have helped us very quickly come on board. We recognize the need. Right, we recognize the need very much, and that's what I know I'm here trying to share.
Tell us more about that. Tell us why, because a lot of people they don't understand why. Tell us why.
Right. So, I mean, the need for change, and like I really want to get into details here, and we're always going to be pressed for time, but the need for like this union, it comes from like so many different I want to say discrepancies, but that kind of like minimizes what's really going on sometimes. I mean, the dangers that we can face from like a lack of safety protocol, a lack of training. There's stories of like financial insecurities that run very, very deep, and
among
lack
employees.
Of job security that, among employees, among workers, among us, stories of job securities being very weak. Our COVID protocol, I mean, we have like a very common consensus that like it was a very dangerous time during COVID where we were not prepared. We were not facing like we were not prepared. We were not equipped with the right resources. We were not equipped with the right responses and trainings. And we saw like some of our employees like contract COVID just from having to work in unsafe environments. And again, it's like a common consensus as of today, even now, like we do not feel any more prepared should another pandemic come around, right? Sorry, my son just yelled out to me in the background.
Dad. You're doing your job. Good dad.
We don't feel any more prepared should another pandemic come around. Should we handle response that we could handle it responsibly? It doesn't really feel like those procedures are in place. And what we really want to say here is like we don't want to criminalize our management as much as like we, the workers that are in the mud, want to like, be able to call for a seat at the table and be able to like call for the necessary change, the safety, the protection, and the successes that can protect the staff. And again, and protect the homeless that like we're serving. I mean, we got to understand, like, it's very dangerous sometimes when you're serving people who can be mentally ill and, you're not equipped with the right trainings, whether it's de-escalation, whether it's trauma-informed, whether it's handling bodily fluids or hazards or needles, or administering Narcan. I mean, none of these trainings are really offered to us, and we want to, and working with such a vulnerable populace, it makes it such a volatile environment sometimes. And I mean, these people need, inspiration, to say the least, really good protection. And we are so often protecting ourselves, right? And we can, and we have a great homeless shelter. We have a great shelter, but like where it could be, versus where it's at is a big reason why we're at the table saying, you know, we want to be able to call on these things. We don't want to, like, you know, I actually like the director. I don't think he's a villain, like overlooking a town, you know, like, no, I think he's like a generally like well-hearted person and like wants to see this change come around for people. So it's like, it's just that we believe, you know, with a more timely response from the workers who are in the field, who are in the mud, organizing and like creating these procedures together, it will create a working environment that, like, I mean, it will, like, it will, you know, it will grow into something much more transparent, beneficial for staff and clientele, helpful, and we'll be able to lean more into the community as well.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. That was Jay Conlon, who works the night shift at Joseph's House and a member of the organized committee to unionize. In a 6-3 split decision, the United States Supreme Court has just struck down a centuries-old New York gun control law. The court held that Americans have a right to carry a handgun outside of the home for self-defense, and that the New York law requiring a showing of special needs for such a permit was too restrictive. Here's the story.
We are talking with Melanie Trimble, who is the regional director of the New York Civility Liberties Union Capital District Chapter. And on Thursday, the United States Supreme Court, in a 6-3 decision, conservatives versus liberals, basically threw out a century-old New York State law that require those seeking a permit to carry a concealed weapon to show that there was a special, you know, threat to them that required them to have the gun and as a concealed weapon. And the United States Supreme Court said, nope, that, you know, violates the Second Amendment. So, Melanie, obviously the decision just, you know, came out very recently, but, you know, what's sort of the general reaction, you know, to what the court has done?
Well, you know, it's really very unfortunate that in the midst of nationwide gun tragedy, the Supreme Court is striking down these regulations that have promoted bolstering safety and protecting people's lives in New York City. It's just incredible that they're taking away the measures that really do keep people safe from gun safety, from gun you know, forcing states to allow people to walk around with hidden weapons of war just makes people more fearful and feel threatened just to be in public spaces. So we're very concerned that the backlash of this will be a very negative, and it's very disheartening.
Now, non-lawyers and particularly younger people, you know, may not, you know, realize that this so-called Second Amendment, the right to a gun, actually is a relatively recent change by the United States Supreme Court. Certainly when I was a law student a couple of decades ago, the idea that you had a right to own a gun because of the Constitution, you know, you would have flunked the constitutional law class. How is it that the Supreme Court seems like they pretty much are willing to strike out in a new direction and not particularly be that concerned about several centuries of decisions sort of leaning the opposite way?
Yeah, the Supreme Court sort of distorted the Second Amendment in 2008. We believe that it's never been about arming individuals. It's really about gun regulations to prohibit a militia. The idea that the Second Amendment means that individuals have a right to carry a gun and particularly to conceal any weapons out in public is just not very counter to what we believe is representative in the Second Amendment. What we're concerned about, of course, is people's safety. Not only that, but also their fear of going out in public spaces. It's been demonstrated quite clearly that in recent incidences that As we our political divisions divide, the people are using violence to express themselves and their displeasure, and giving people the right to carry concealed weapons will only exacerbate the problem that we have already with gun violence in America.
Now, the United States Supreme Court, you know, is, you know, seen as the ultimate decision maker in terms of what our laws are allowed to do or not allowed to do. But at the same time, the Supreme Court tends to leave open the doors a little bit with their decisions, you know, unless your situation is directly on point to what they decided. So are there any avenues that, you know, those who wish to see some reasonable control of guns, particularly concealed weapons, are likely to pursue at this point? Or, you know, how does one respond to the United States Supreme Court in this 6-3 decision?
Right. Well, the decision leaves open a place that it prohibits, well, it doesn't prohibit, but it allows for regulation to be placed in sensitive places, which has not been clearly defined, but we believe that it would include places like subways, schools, churches, places of protest, places where alcohol is being served, and high density public areas. So given that, through the decision, we're hoping that New York State, the legislature, and the governor sees very clearly the direction ahead in order to regulate guns in those sensitive areas, at least, to take what has come out of the Supreme Court and bolster the laws in New York State to go as far as we can to protect the public from gun violence in the future. So there are things that can be done legislatively, and we hope that the legislature sees clear to do that, as well as the governor, who has pledged, by the way, to work with gun safety and trying to rein in our use of weapons in public spaces.
No, I remember living in Arizona several decades ago, and that is a state where it is has been legal to carry openly guns, and it was always quite startling when you see somebody, you know, being a little agitated and running at you, and you notice that they actually have a gun on them, and it's like, oh, is this guy just late for a meeting, or is, you know, something, you know, more sinister occurring? You know, for those who read tea leaves, you know, what does this tell us? Anything new about the direction of the Supreme Court, or is just that this 6-3 split between the conservatives and the liberals is just getting firmer?
Oh, I don't know. So if I want to talk about the history of the legacy of the Supreme Court at this point, you know, that knowing that we're waiting for an awfully big decision that takes women's right to control their bodies that may be coming down. I mean, it's pretty clear to everybody in what direction this court is headed. I don't think I need to comment on it. But one thing that's pretty clear is that we're looking at a very dangerous time for all of us, not only being able to protect ourselves from people who are concealing weapons in public spaces, but also to be able to protect women's bodies and their right to choose. So, you know, it's a scary time for all of us. I think we need to participate more in our democracy than we have. We've been too complacent over the last few years, probably too many years at this point. We need to start really participating in government, voting, using our strength to and our opinions to move this country in the direction of sanity, as opposed to taking rights away from people or to instilling rights for people who want to destroy others.
Well, you're talking about voting. Are there particular voting rights measures? I know, you know, New York just signed in, I guess, the John Lewis voting rights law, but are there other, you know, voting rights issues that the Civil Liberties Union is looking at?
Well, the ACLU has worked very hard to try and get some national legislation that will rein in these states from imposing all kinds of impediments to people getting to the voting booth. And gerrymandering is a huge problem. So we're hoping that, you know, our federal legislators will see clear to really work on enfranchising people to be able to vote, to be able to participate in democracy, so that we don't shut the government down and become, you know, one that doesn't respond to the people and their voices.
And if people want to keep up to speed with what the New York Civil Liberties Union is doing, particularly in the Capital Region, how best to do that?
Oh, they can always go to our website, nyclu.org. Locally, they should just email me, mtrimble@nyclu.org. We're hoping to do some work with the students at Albany High that on the track team that had have run into trouble with the way they dress. You know, these are clearly infractions that should never have been brought against these young ladies. And we're hoping to prevail there and get all of the students exonerated from any kind of disciplinary charges that they have faced. And they ought to be able to wear what the boy, you know, whatever they, you know, think is appropriate for sportswear.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. We've been talking to Melanie Trimble, the regional director of the New York Civil Liberties Union Capital District Chapter. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
In case you hadn't heard, the U.S. Supreme Court just decided to overturn longstanding handgun laws in New York. Stay tuned to Hudson Mohawk Magazine for developments in this breaking story.
For those of you just tuning in, I'm Sina Bazila-Hickey.
And I'm Kathy Silber. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network on WOOCLP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOSLP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOALP 106.9 FM Albany, WOOGLP 92.7 FM Troy, and WCAALP 107.3 FM Albany. This program comes from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the unceded homelands of the Mohican people, known today as the Stockbridge-Muncie community.
This program covers stories of social and environmental justice produced by the community, for the community, and is supported by independent donations. To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
Last week, Penny Holmes, director of the ARC Incorporated in Troy, joined us to talk about the Juneteenth screening of a feature film about trauma and resilience. Penny has been instrumental in bringing trauma-informed practices to the Capital District through several different organizations. I'm delighted to say Penny joins us right now to tell us more. Welcome, Penny.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
No, I'm delighted to have you. I was so interested last week as we were preparing for our other interview to hear about your work in this trauma-informed area. I almost feel like we should turn trauma-informed into a noun rather than an adjective. But can you tell us what is that? What does that mean, trauma-informed?
Trauma-informed, it's really focused on that there's trauma that you can have and don't even realize in your youth that you bring into your adult life. That's it in a very simple form. And how I got involved with it is I was brought on by CEO, which is the local nonprofit, to oversee the One Troy ESPRI funding. And what that particular funding was money that was given to the city of Troy to go into the North Central community and to sponsor projects throughout the community that would benefit the community that had the input of the stakeholders of the community. And one of the programs that was funded was trauma-informed. That was something that the community wanted because they knew that there were a lot of issues that stemmed from childhood trauma that led into their adult life. And so we brought on Lisa Good, who's a known local specialist in trauma-informed. And she led a whole charge within the community, offering different workshops and opportunities to come out and talk in the school districts and within some of the community meetings. And it was powerful. It was really, really powerful, which led to the movie showing this weekend of Sunshine Circle.
I mean, you're making the emphasis here on childhood trauma. And I think that there's a distinction, a meaningful distinction. If you experience a traumatic event as a full-grown adult, your brain is already developed. You have an adult's understanding of the world. Certainly trauma is trauma, and it's
absolutely
but you have more resources as an adult to try to get through it. Whereas if it happens when you're a child, it interferes with the regular development of the nervous system and the brain, and it changes the way one's ability to interact in the world and produces all kinds of unfortunate outcomes for individuals, for families, and for communities. And this is what came out in the event that you organized last week. So you have, so in your work doing that, I'm wondering now, you had told me the other day that you had worked in, hadn't you also worked in Albany and Schenectady?
Yes.
And then you came back to Troy. Can you tell us about your path in this work and the kinds of, maybe go into a little more detail about the specific kinds of programming that you were helpful with?
Okay. I started off actually at the Boys and Girls Club in Albany. Mm-hmm. I was the chief professional officer for almost 20 years.
Wow.
And working with youth from ages from kindergarten up to 18 years of age. Mm-hmm. And I actually left to raised my own child. I had a child a little bit later in life. Mm. And when I was home for a couple of years, I said, I'm ready to go back. So when I went back out there, I was working at the Hamilton Hill Arts Center. And my charge was the same, cultural events, looking at the community, seeing what input we could have. Mm-hmm. And at that time, I was led to bring cultural programs within the Capital District. Mm-hmm. And so ARC is which I'm very familiar with. I grew up in New York, still had a great relationship with the founders. And I said, hey, let's bring some cultural enrichment programs into the ARC program. And also they had the ARC Community Charter School. So for me, this is in short, like full circle, because I grew up, I was a child in this program at 8 years of age. And now I'm overseeing the operations of it.
Oh, wow. So tell us more about the ARC. I've got to say, I'm completely ignorant. I know nothing.
Well, the ARC is a cultural enrichment program that was founded in the Public Housing Authority, the Troy Housing Authority. And what we offer is enrichment programs, from mentoring, from nutrition, to parenting programs, to homework assistance program. We did a lot of work during the COVID because of our children being out of school. So we ran full day programs. We run summer programs. A lot of it is really looking at where that child is and how we can empower them, as well as the family, and being that linkage. And we're now housed back into the Housing Authority, which we were away for a while. So not only did I come back home, we came back home as an organization.
So how many families do you serve, or how do you ever you quantify the extent of your reach?
Well, we're a licensed program, and our program currently has, I would say, close to 60 students. Mm-hmm. We're looking to open up another site within a public housing site. But along with that, we're working with a lot of the local organizations like Team Hero, Snug, CEO, Trip, and so forth. So, you know, one thing that we're looking at now is what makes that child a full circle. So we're looking at from their education to working from housing needs to nutrition needs. What, you know, to make that child really centered is to make the family centered.
Mm-hmm. That is, Sina, do you have any, are you curious about anything in particular here?
Well, you're mentioning a lot of really amazing organizations that we have also worked with, Jerry Ford and Team Hero and Trip. And how do you find support from the community? What are some really important support systems that you find is really unique in this neighborhood?
You know, I think the support come from a lot of the organizations that are here, that they've been here. We've been here around since 1978. So I think it comes from the families we serve and that we network with each other. If it's something that I can't handle, I know if they need housing, I can call on Trip. I know if there's some issues going on with young teens, I know I can call on Jerry to assist with that. I think it's just a very strong grassroots community that we have, and we have all implement having our residents and stakeholders be a part of our decision making. And I think that has been instrumental in a lot of what we do.
And how important are these support systems? You're talking about childhood development. How important are these really strong childhood experiences for healthy adulthood and creating better ecosystems in our communities?
You know, it's very important because I think, you know, oftentimes we don't realize we carry our childhood into our adult life. And if it wasn't handled when we were young, many times we don't realize, oh, that happened 30 years ago and it's coming back to light now. The light bulb goes off. So I think it's very important. And, you know, and a lot of our children are going through many issues. So it's important that we have that village around them, because someone in that village may be able to reach them when the next person wasn't. You just never know. It's the simplest thing.
Well, we appreciate you so much.
I see that every day.
We appreciate you coming on to talk with us. And hopefully you will come on again. Your neighbor from the sanctuary just around the corner.
Yes, we are.
So thank you so much.
I would love to.
We'll look forward to having you back. Thanks, Penny.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Penny Holmes, director of the ARC Incorporated in Troy, just around the corner. And this was a conversation around trauma-informed. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Next up, Capital District Reclaim Pride is a grassroots organizing movement working to serve the LGBTQIA and more community of New York's Capital Region. Their Facebook reads, no cops, no corporations, just locals with an interest in queer mutual aid. HMM producer Elizabeth Press brings us the story.
Well, as we know, June is Pride, and today we are talking about Capital District Reclaim Pride with one of the volunteers for Capital District Reclaim Pride, Max Burke. Max, welcome to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Thanks for having me.
You know, what is Pride to you?
I mean, it's a couple things. It's, you know, at a base level, it is about being your truest self, ignoring any kind of societal, religious, any of the grief and guilt that we've, you know, so many of us have unfortunately been raised with that stopped us from living ourselves and just being the truest possible version of ourselves that we can be. Additionally, and that's kind of part of why we put this together, I think Pride is about remembering just how much we still have to go to be treated like human beings in so much of this world and so much of this country, that there's still a lot of fighting to be done, that it's not just a time for celebration, it's a time for remembering that we're not done with this battle at all.
Thanks for that, Max. And the name of your group is Capital District Reclaim Pride. Before we get to your event this coming weekend, could you just talk about this idea of reclaiming pride and why?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the core concept of reclaiming pride is that in the modern era, pride has become taken over by corporations, by politicians, and is chock full of cops. And so let's run through why these are issues. Corporations don't care about queer people. They care about profits. Like any major corporation, they go where the profits are. You can see this very easily by, I'm certain Volkswagen has some real good, you know, Pride Month logos. And back in the 30s and 40s, they had some real good Nazi logos because that's what was working at the time. And it's important to remember that to them, we're just a source of profit, something to be marketed during June so they can sell more rainbow-themed merchandise, more whatever. They can show that they're progressive. And ultimately, they don't have our backs. So many corporations that have massive, you know, presences and pride parades and, you know, do the logos and all that stuff. Also, their CEOs are giving money to homophobic organizations and to politicians that are trying to make our lives so much worse. speaking of politicians, politicians, again, tend to go where the votes are and where they feel will give them the most political capital. Like, they get trotted out during June. They'll trot out queer people to show that they're progressive, that they believe in all of this, but in reality, their legislation won't show that level of dedication. A good example of this on a large scale that just happened is Hillary Clinton, in an interview, said that the trans question shouldn't be a priority for the Democrats. The only focus should be winning, which, how are we as queer people, as trans people, supposed to feel voting Democrat, you know, the progressive party, if our existence isn't a priority to these people, you know? And cops, it's because Pride started as a riot. Like, it started as the Stonewall riots and then remembrance of the Stonewall riots, which were against cops doing graft and corruption at gay bars and people just being absolutely sick and tired of it. And it's important to remember that. And like, so many queer people are still at risk of cops, especially queer people of color. And creating a environment where people can be safe, where there's not a giant presence of your oppressor and people that you have real visceral trauma with, is a very important part of Pride. I think that's all I got to say about that.
Max, thank you for going into why it's important to reclaim Pride for you. And as part of this, Capital District Reclaim Pride is hosting an event on Saturday, June 25th in Albany's Townsend Park. I was wondering if you could spend a little bit of time telling us about what you have planned for Saturday.
Saturday, as you mentioned, 12 to 5 p.m., Townsend Park. We're going to have a lot of really cool stuff. We're going to have a couple of local queer entertainers, musicians playing. We're going to have a number of local queer comics, including myself. We're going to have a lot of speakers, local activists who want to speak more on the political side of Reclaim Pride. And we'll also be having, from 12 to 1, we will be having a children's hour. Right now it looks like some kind of drag queen storytelling and possibly a couple other things. And then throughout the day, we'll have like an activities table, like a crafts table, I believe. We'll be having a number of different types of free food. There will also be at least one table of free clothing from another side project that a number of us who volunteer with Reclaim Pride do, called the Free Store, because we also believe, you know, clothing should be a thing everyone should have. And there's going to be like a 50-50 raffle happening so that we can hopefully put some of the proceeds, or all the proceeds, into the pockets of our performers and speakers so they can at least get a little bit of compensation for their time. And yeah, it should just be a good day of good vibes, socializing with folks, getting to see some wonderful performers and some rousing speakers.
And is there anyone specifically that's speaking that you're looking forward to hearing from? I saw some folks from Saratoga BLM are on the list of speakers.
Well, so for me personally, I'm just excited for all of them. Like, a lot of them are people that I have worked with in some capacity since 2020, pretty much since George Floyd and all the latest, you know, BLM protests kicked off. I was a medic for a lot of that in the local area. So a lot of them are people I know and I've heard speak, and I'm just excited to see them, and also to see them get to see, you know, a new and different audience, or at least potentially give their voice to new people who hadn't heard it before.
I'd been to one of your Reclaim Pride events in the past. Capital District Reclaim Pride, where do you see it going?
Pre-COVID, it did exist, but it was structurally, from my understanding, a much different form. I wasn't involved back then, but essentially it kind of served more as an alternative demonstration, perhaps, to the actual Pride celebration. It would happen the same weekend. It would be something to remind people that these terrible things are still happening in our city, even while our mayor is, you know, claiming that she loves queer people so much, and yet this issue is still a thing. It would be things like that. More kind of protesty in nature, more smaller scale. This came about after COVID. A couple of us organizers who worked on various projects together started it, we're talking about, hey, we need a pride thing again. Like, this year's just got canceled. This was last year in 2021. It just got announced that it's not happening. We need to put something together. And like, we'd already been kind of talking of it. So that galvanized us into doing more a festival kind of thing, but keeping it more radically centered. How it will be this weekend is a newer thing, but the organization has been around for four or five-ish years, something like that. And then the future, I'm not super great at looking beyond the just now. For me, oh, in the future, it'll be a successful Reclaim Pride this weekend. And hopefully as things grow, we'll be able, like next year, hopefully we'll be able to have more speakers and performers or more new voices that we haven't had. To have new people reaching out to us to be involved would be absolutely stellar.
There are Reclaim Pride events in other cities. I'm wondering if there is a model of Reclaim Pride that Capital District Reclaim Pride models off of.
Originally, when our group was started, there was a bit of like crosstalk with folks who ran the New York City Reclaim Pride, but other than that, I don't really know per se, other than the general structure and idea, because I feel a lot of the groups are similar concepts, but the execution may or may not differ.
Awesome. Well, thank you for joining us today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Thank you for having me.
That was Elizabeth Press talking with Max Burke about Capital District Reclaim Pride. And again, that festival is on Saturday, June 25th. Noon to 5 o'clock at Townsend Park on Henry Johnson Boulevard in Albany.
And it's that time once again in our show for a weekly check-in with the community group. And today we're joined by Shauna Davis of the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists. Welcome, Shauna.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for being here. I understand you've been on the road for negotiations, and I appreciate that you made the time to do this. We touched base a little bit on the various aspects that we might talk about. And I think I would like to talk about the things that are most important. And then if we have time, maybe we can fill in with structural things like the different levels and the national organization. But what is your, as for the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists, what's your role with them? You're the president, is that right?
So I'm the president of the Capital District chapter.
Yeah, exactly. And So what in your mind is the most important thing that you guys are doing?
The most important thing is educating poor and minority people about the importance of the labor movement and the importance of them being a part of their union if they are in one. Mm-hmm. You know, and what role the union actually plays really in their daily life.
Do you find that in general, there's a sort of, without doing this education work, people will just think, oh, well, that doesn't have anything to do with me?
I think people, unfortunately, there's some disconnect that people only go to the union when they need the union, right? Like, so I don't get in trouble. I go to work every day. I go to work on time. I do my job effectively. So what do I need the union for? Mm-hmm. And so the ability to understand the importance of why you're in a union and the fact that you are the union, you're the reason that the union exists, is how do you continue to pay dues to an organization, but you don't know what it is that they can do for you other than protect you if you get in trouble. It's so much more than that.
Do you feel like it's become easier right now? There's definitely been an increase in visibility for union work. Younger people are becoming more engaged with, I mean, Starbucks and Amazon being the prime examples. Has it become a little bit easier to communicate about the importance of unions?
I think it's a little complex. So I think it depends on the actual workforce. It is amazing to see so much organizing going on and so many more young people really standing up and speaking to the fact that they have a voice and they have a role in what working looks like for them. But being able to get them to understand that it doesn't stop with the organizing, that the education and the leadership has to continue even after you get the union. And so that's twofold, though. The organization itself, once these workers are organized, has a responsibility to educate and bring them along and show them what it is that needs to be done. But then also the people that have been organized have to want that as well.
We were talking earlier about this kind of contradiction between a very grassroots, worker-centered, worker-led movement, and the fact that given the historical successes of unionizing in America over the last many decades, even though that's now even been so successful, there's been a time for it to be on decline, but the level of institutionalization of the unions themselves makes it harder sometimes for individual workers to feel like the union is really them. It may feel more like it's this external organization. And we were talking earlier about kind of navigating that tension. Can you say more about that?
So sometimes I think it's hard for people to realize what role they can actually play in a union. A lot of times the leadership doesn't look like you. A lot of times the leadership doesn't communicate the way you communicate. A lot of times the leadership fails to include everyone in all aspects of job titles, individuals. You were speaking with someone from Pride earlier. So just including every culture in the organization. And so there sometimes is a disconnect because that communication has to happen. It has to become more inclusive. And I feel like that is still a struggle even today.
I hear you. And I think it's part of a greater irony, but it cuts particularly sharply for marginalized communities, for Black people. The union created to level out some hierarchical differences becomes a hierarchical institution, and any individual occupying any position of power may or may not be in the mood to be inclusive, may capriciously exercise racism. And so it's a differential relationship for people of color and other marginalized people within a union. It's not as easy as becoming empowered. It's like, oh yeah, become empowered, but then shut up, right? And we're not including you.
We're not including you, right? Become empowered, pay your dues, participate in the benefits, and that's it.
Yeah.
And so it has to be, it's so much broader than that. So it's a continuous work. It's a continuous cycle for people to understand that you're more than a union member. And how it works for us is how we make it work.
One of the other things that you were talking about was the commitment that you personally and your organization feels to coalition building and just being working in coalition with other organizations and all the reinventing of the wheel and all the stepping on each other's toes or maybe tripping over each other's feet. Can you talk about, this is a well-known problem, I think, among well-meaning people in organizations. Can you talk about some of the successes that you've had with that?
I think some of the successes are when we actually can collaborate together. So the Coalition of Black Trade Union and CBTU is a constituency group which falls under the umbrella of the union, along with other constituency groups like LACLA, which is the Latin Council for Latino Americans, Pride at Work, APALA, Asian Pacific workers as well. So these constituency groups are groups that come together of like-minded and like-culture people that have conversations about how we can advance in the union movement, but also become a part of the important conversations that take place at negotiation tables or in leadership boardrooms that we may not have always been a part of. Mm-hmm. And so to be able to educate members, to let them know that they're more than just their union dues, that they have a voice, and encouraging them to understand that that voice is important And we've had some successes in different unions, and that may look different for some, where like some unions will have minority committees or minority caucuses or create minority roles. Other unions are still working on those type of things.
Wow. So we're almost out of time. We just have maybe we have 2 minutes. What would you like our listeners to know about Coalition of Black Trade Unionists?
The Coalition of Black Trade Unionists is an amazing organization. Honestly, because of the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists, I am more active in my local union. It was through CBTU that I was educated and able to understand that I had a bigger role in the union organization that I'm a member of. And William Bill Lucy, he is the founder and first president. Organization was 1972, was created. He's an amazing man. He marched with Dr. Martin Luther King. He worked with the apartheid. He stood in the parking lot with three people to talk about how to get Nelson Mandela out of jail, and it happened. I am humbled and honored to be a part of such an organization that I can't nearly reach the things that he reached, but maybe one day I will. But to be a part of that, I want people to know that they can also be a part of that as well.
Thank you so much for coming onto the show and telling us about your important work. We will look forward to having you back on a regular basis.
Awesome. Thank you for having me. It's been an honor. I appreciate it.
Honors is all ours. And we'll see you next time.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Bye.
And that concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Sina Bazila-Hickey.
And I'm Kathy Silber. Our engineer is Sina Bazila-Hickey. Our content is produced entirely by volunteers. To learn how you can contribute to local stories of social and environmental justice, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Thank you to all our volunteers and sanctuary sustainers. If you value independent media, consider a gift of a monthly donation as a sanctuary sustainer by going to mediasanctuary.org. And we really want to hear from you. How do you experience Hudson Mohawk Magazine? What resonates most? What could we be doing better? Tune in every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to hear local news or stream Sanctuary Radio at mediasanctuary.org. Hudson Mohawk Magazine is also available on demand as a podcast or as individual stories at mediasanctuary.org. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.